This is Free Speech Radio News for Friday, December 7, 2007, from KPFK in LA. I'm Aura Bogado. The CIA admits to destroying interrogation tapes, and it raises questions on the agency's use of torture. Walmart workers in Mexico City organize a growing underground network demanding better working conditions. And despite a new report that indicates that Iran halted its nuclear weapons program years ago, the Bush administration moves for new sanctions. Those stories and more after the headlines.
I'm Shannon Young with today's headlines. The South Korean Coast Guard is racing against time to clean up a massive oil spill off the country's west coast. Earlier today, a barge slammed into a tanker, releasing an estimated 15,000 tons of crude into the sea. Cleanup crews are now trying to prevent the leakage from reaching land. Jason Strother reports from Seoul.
A Hong Kong-registered tanker, the Hebei Spirit, was anchored off the coast of the port city of Daesan, about 50 miles southwest of Seoul, when it was struck by a crane-carrying barge. It's the worst accident of this kind to ever hit South Korea. According to the Coast Guard here, around 66,000 barrels of oil have spilled into the waters. Officials say they have less than 48 hours until the oil reaches the shoreline. Choi Sang-hwan is head of the South Korean Coast Guard. In situations like this, we're supposed to perform operations to prevent further spreading of oil, he says. But we are not able to do this quickly because of bad weather conditions. To put the spill into perspective, it's about a third of the size of the 1989 Exxon Valdez disaster off the Alaskan coastline. Officials at the South Korean Maritime Ministry say they cannot yet predict the extent of damage that the spill will cause to the local environment. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Jason Strother in Seoul, South Korea.
One day after House Democrats celebrated the passage of an ambitious energy bill, the Senate voted to table it for now. Yanmei Xie has the story from Capitol Hill.
The energy bill maps out a plan to cut fossil fuel consumption and increase renewable energy production for decades to come. Majority Leader Senator Harry Reid says it's a landmark plan.
This Energy and Security Act will finally put America on a right track to solve our grave and growing energy crisis.
Most senators support raising mileage standards for cars. But Republicans and several Democrats oppose the provision that would require utilities to produce more electricity from renewables. They're also against cutting tax breaks for oil companies. Opponents of the bill prevailed.
On this vote, the yeas are 53, the nays are 42. The motion.
The bill needed 60 votes to proceed. New Mexico Republican Pete Domenech is vice chairman of the Energy Committee. He accuses Democrats of political posturing by bringing up a bill that's sure to fail.
This is not a bill. It's a message. Messages are messy.
Leaders from both parties will be negotiating for a compromise this weekend. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Ye Meixie on Capitol Hill.
Lebanon's presidential vote was postponed for a seventh time today as lawmakers from the Western-backed ruling coalition and the Hezbollah-led opposition iron out the final details that would allow the country's army chief to assume power. Jackson Ellers has more from Beirut.
Lebanon's parliamentary speaker Nabi Berri said the presidential vote in parliament would be held on December 11th. And while Army Chief Michel Soleiman has emerged as the consensus candidate for both political camps, Soleiman cannot assume power until the constitution is amended to allow for a public servant in his position to run for office. But amending the constitution might prove difficult as the new president will be responsible for helping to form a new government. Analysts say both the pro-Western government and the Hezbollah-led opposition are afraid to cede any power in this process. One presidential hopeful and leading Christian opposition figure, Michel Aoun, said they will agree on Soleiman as president only if the amendment stipulates he must step down in June 2009 legislative elections. Reporting from Beirut, Lebanon, this is Jackson Allers for Free Speech Radio News.
A Denver County court convicted three anti-war activists yesterday of trespassing for refusing to leave their senator's office. Nikki Kaiser has more.
Korean War veteran Rafael Eggers, Catholic worker Sue Gomez, and homeless advocate Arnie Carter were fined $50 each for their refusal to leave the Denver offices of Senator Ken Salazar. They went to Salazar's office with other anti-war activists on February 21st to urge the senator to take a stronger stance against war funding. The action was part of a coordinated national campaign called Occupation Project. The three were arrested after they refused to leave at the end of office hours. Their attorney, Walter Goresh, argued the three had a moral obligation to oppose an unjust war and the right to assemble peacefully in a public office paid for by taxpayers in order to speak with their lawmakers. The presiding judge suspended all fines and court costs shortly after the jury returned their guilty verdict. Senator Salazar has since become a leading opponent of requests for additional funding for the war in Iraq. Nikki Kaiser, FSRN, Boulder.
And those are today's headlines. I'm Shannon Young.
Congress is calling for investigations into the latest news that the CIA destroyed tapes depicting interrogations of terrorism suspects. As Washington editor Leanne Caldwell reports, the news raises more concerns on the U.S.'s use of torture and the CIA's clandestine activity and apparent cover-up.
At the beginning of the CIA's secret rendition program, they videotaped interrogations of suspected al-Qaeda member Abu Zubaydah. In a letter to CIA employees last night, Director Michael Hayden laid out the details of the interrogation tapes that were made in 2002 and then destroyed in 2005. Hayden, who was not director at the time, said the tapes were made for internal review, but in 2005 the CIA determined they were no longer needed and must be destroyed because they posed a security threat to the interrogators and their families. But at the same time they were demolished, Congress was debating the Detainee Treatment Act, a law that loosened torture standards but could still implicate interrogators' illegal tactics.
It's bad enough that the CIA destroyed evidence that could have been used to hold CIA agents accountable for the torture of prisoners.
Jamil Jaffer, attorney with the American Civil Liberties Union, also says the tapes were kept secret during times they should have been released.
But I think it reaches another level altogether when the CIA did this at a time that the tapes were a subject of ongoing litigation.
The ACLU had a Freedom of Information request pending with the CIA on their secret interrogation program. The attorneys for Abu Musawi, convicted 9/11 terrorist, also requested such tapes for the court case, as did the 9/11 Commission when writing their report. The tapes were kept hidden. Meredith Fuchs is general counsel for the National Security Archives. She says the destruction of CIA evidence is not new.
In the late 90s, it was reported that documents relating to the CIA's operations in Iran in 1953 had been destroyed. And in 1953, there was a coup against the premier of Iran, Mohammad Mossadegh. And eventually, the National Archives looked into this, and they concluded that it was unauthorized. Similarly, there are records of CIA behavior control experiments throughout the 60s, and those were destroyed as well in the 70s. So it's not new that the CIA would try to cover its tracks by destroying records.
Democrats in Congress expressed outrage.
The Bush administration has run roughshod over our ideals and the rule of law. Before those 6 years, the Republican Congress did little to hold the administration accountable. Now, when the new Democratic Congress is demanding answers, the administration is feverishly covering up its tracks. We haven't seen anything like this since the 18 and a half minute gap in the tapes of President Richard Nixon.
Senator Edward Kennedy of Massachusetts and fellow lawmakers are calling on Attorney General Michael Mukasey to investigate, even though Mukasey would not admit to calling waterboarding torture at his confirmation hearing. CIA Director Hayden says Congress was informed about the destruction of the tapes, something chairs of the intelligence committees deny. Just hours before this story broke, the House and Senate agreed to legislation that would outlaw torture for all government employees, not just military personnel. President Bush's current interpretation of the law has attempted to blur the lines between lawful interrogations and torture used by the CIA. That's a perception of the law that Harold Nelson, advocacy director for the Torture Abolition and Survivors Coalition, says is appalling.
Why wouldn't this occur? This is an administration that has not only condoned torture, but ordered it. George Bush ordered it, violation of the law.
The president has threatened to veto Congress's government-wide ban on torture, even though this version is watered down and does not apply retroactively. Therefore, CIA interrogators would not be held accountable. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
A report from the U.S. intelligence community made public this week states that, according to its best estimate, Iran halted work on its nuclear bomb plans in 2003. That finding goes against earlier reports that indicate that Iran is continuing to pursue nuclear weapons. The report, issued by the National Intelligence Estimate, the same think tank that said Iraq had chemical and biological weapons in 2002, was welcomed by many in the international community. Yet, addressing the press earlier this week, President Bush said that there's still reason to think that Iran poses a nuclear danger.
We know they had a program. We know the program was halted. I think it is very important for the international community to recognize the fact that if Iran were to develop the knowledge that they could transfer to a clandestine program, it would create a danger for the world. And so I view this report as a warning signal.
Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice, meanwhile, met with European allies in Belgium, rallying support for new UN sanctions against Iran. And despite the new report indicating that Iran has halted its nuclear weapons program, she was able to garner some support.
We talked again about the UN Security Council track, about the need to use that track to try to stimulate the Iranian regime to take the negotiating track that is available to them.
But some observers say that regardless of evidence, the Bush administration's position on Iran is purely ideological. Mohammed Sahimi is professor of chemical and petroleum engineering at the University of California and has published extensively on Iran's political developments and its nuclear program.
The Bush administration and the British government had already decided that the Iranian government is guilty. Therefore, nothing is going to get in the way of them trying to impose more sanctions on Iran. France had a more reasonable approach to Iran before Nicolas Sarkozy became the president of France. But since he was elected president of France, he has also taken a hardline and, in my view, unreasonable approach to Iran. He has also decided that Iran is guilty, no matter what the International Atomic Energy Agency reports, or in this case, the National Intelligence Estimate of the United States says. So it doesn't really surprise me that the British government and the government of Nicolas Sarkozy would go along imposing more sanctions against Iran. But I believe it will be far more difficult and probably impossible now to convince Russia and China to go along. And this even raises the possibility that either one of them or both of them may even veto any United Nations Security Council resolution for more sanctions against Iran.
And as you say, Russia and China are certainly resisting new Iran sanctions. How do you think this is eventually going to fare for Iran?
Well, what might happen is that the United States or the Bush administration may not be able to get the Security Council to issue a new set of sanctions against Iran. So what might happen is that the administration and some of its European allies may decide on their own to impose unilateral sanctions against Iran. Remember, the most important commercial partner of Iran is the European Union. So if the European Union, led by France and the British government, decide that they actually want to go ahead with new sanctions, they might do that. But at the same time, we have to remember Germany is the top commercial partner of Iran, and Germany has been hesitant to go along with more sanctions. And not having the consent of the German government would be a big hindrance against the efforts of the Bush administration and Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice to get the European Union to act in a united front against Iran.
To read more about Professor Sahimi's analysis on Iran, go to www.payvand.org. That's P-A-Y-V-A-N-D.org. Several campaign developments have occurred over the past week on the Democratic and Republican side, including an escalating confrontation between Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama, and Mitt Romney's attempt to clear the record on the influence of his Mormon religion on his politics. Zain Al-Amin reports from Washington, D.C.
Barack Obama launched a new website called HillaryAttacksBarackObama.com to document Clinton's attacks and to raise funds. The campaign features prominently a video clip of Hillary declaring that now the fun begins, promising to respond to attacks made on her.
I have been 4 months on the receiving end of rather consistent attacks. Well, now the fun part starts.
This clip was contrasted with another earlier video from the campaign trail where Clinton tells the audience that she's not interested in attacking her Democratic opponents. On the Republican front, Mitt Romney delivered an address at the Bush Presidential Library intended to clarify his position on the role of religion in his presidency. But his attempts to distance his Mormonism from his possible presidency and at the same time cater to the evangelical Christian voters resulted in contradictory statements.
Freedom requires religion, just as religion requires freedom. Let me assure you that no authorities of my church, or of any other church for that matter, will ever exert influence on presidential decisions.
Lastly, John McCain was the only one to respond to MTV's invitation to Republican candidates to debate. After failing to sound hip and referring to his interviewer as the worst interviewer by mistake, he identified global warming as one of the most important issues of his campaign. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Zain Al-Amin in Washington, D.C.
After Cyclone Sidr peaked and made landfall in Bangladesh's coastal region last month, it left some 2 million people homeless, and the Red Crescent Society estimates that it killed as many as 10,000. While efforts to provide even immediate emergency relief are still catching up to meet the enormous demands, analysts say many Bangladeshis will face long-term malnutrition and extreme poverty. Shakil Ahmed reports.
On the island of Dublar Chor, adjacent to the Sundarban mangrove forest on Bangladesh coastal line, people are still waiting for adequate relief supplies. Matlub Majhi, a 65-year-old fisherman from the island, survived Cyclone Sidr but lost his wife and 3 children to the storm. He says now he is dying too. He says, we don't need anything, no home, no money. We just need some water and food. Please save our life first. Farmer Abdul Karim from the nearby town of Borishal explains that like the fishing community on the island, farmers in the coastal belt have also lost everything. He says the rice seedling he just planted have been destroyed, leaving him with debts and no harvest. Hundreds of thousands of acres of rice, paddies and vegetable gardens have been completely destroyed. In total, Bangladesh has lost roughly 1 million tons, almost all of its expected rice harvest for this year. Rejaul Karim Chaudhary works with the coastal inhabitants to improve their livelihoods.
Already we have 50% of our children are suffer out of malnutrition. It will increase undoubtedly.
Tapan Chaudhary is disaster management advisor to the caretaker government in Dhaka. He says Bangladesh was already expecting a shortfall of nearly 1 million tons of rice. The cyclone devastation will lead to double suffering.
It's not the money we need now, but food grains. Up to March, we'll finish our local production. Then we'll be needing some 10 lakh tons of rice.
Chaudhary is asking donor agencies to buy food from outside Bangladesh to avoid driving prices within the country up. Analysts say that despite this assistance, Bangladesh economy will still hang in the balance. Rezaul Karim Chaudhary, who is executive director of an NGO called COAST, believes Sidr was an effect of global warming. He says the impact of climate change are responsible for reduced production of crucial staples globally, a 40% fall in the production of wheat, for example.
This year in Australia, 40% wheat has not, there is a production deficit of 40%. And because of this, the level of wheat, price has been increased. The question how government will be able to afford to purchase the high price of the wheat.
He demands compensation from developing countries responsible for most of the greenhouse gas emissions that lead to global warming.
International donors have to give aid to those because this is a matter of compensation. Because a Bangladeshi person emit annually only 0.2 ton of carbon. And one American citizen annually emit 20 ton of carbon.
Many fear that CEDAR has pushed 500,000 people deeper into poverty that will last for another generation, even without factoring the high possibility of more devastating storms. For Free Speech Radio News in Dhaka, I'm Shakil Ahmed.
Voters in Bolivia are preparing to participate in a historic referendum once delegates craft a new constitution due later this month. Juliet Beck and Aldo Arellana Lopez report from Bolivia, where President Morales has made a stunning new declaration and where protests on both sides of the referendum debate continue.
Firecrackers announced the arrival of a diverse array of demonstrators into the central square of Cochabamba, the site where 7 years ago people organized en masse to successfully reverse corporate control of the city's water. Yesterday, thousands of marchers gathered with the hope to make privatization of basic services a policy of the past. This is just one of the changes that they hope to enshrine in a new constitution. Roberta Vargas of the Workers' Federation spoke at the closing Cabildo, or popular assembly, in the plaza.
We are here to say to those shameless traitors that want to sell off our country, no more.
Conservative land and industry-owning elite in the eastern region of the country, known as the Media Luna, or Half Moon, have recently become more active in what some fear is a right-wing offensive to destabilize the country to block reforms. Bolivia's Constituent Assembly has until December 14th, less than a week, to complete its task of drafting a new constitution. For many social movements, this constitution is a critical step in reversing two decades of free market or neoliberal economic reforms and fully recognizing Bolivia's indigenous diversity. Marta Vasquez, a 21-year-old Secretary of Youth and Culture for the Women Campesina Federation, Bartolina Cisis, in Santa Cruz, explains the significance.
In the Constituent Assembly, we are demanding to be recognized. Before, indigenous people were not recognized. They treated us like animals with no rights. Not anymore. Now we are deciding for ourselves the type of education we want, according to our languages, the type of health care we want, the kind of justice system we want, the kind of politics we want to follow.
Last week, conservative elites in the eastern resource-rich part of the country called a general strike in six of Bolivia's nine provinces. This week, more than 200 conservatives initiated a hunger strike to oppose a government plan to pay for Social Security-like payments for the elderly. Four opposition governors traveled to the U.S. to plead their case that Bolivia was slipping towards autocratic rule. The controversial governor of Cochabamba, Manfred Reyes Villa, a School of the Americas graduate and chief proponent of the privatization of Cochabamba's water utilities, was among those who made the trip. Last month, Manfred called on his ex-colleagues in the military to forcibly remove President Evo Morales from office. These moves have provoked fear among some Bolivians that the right is systematically attempting to destabilize the democratically elected MAS, or Movement Towards Socialism, government, both within and outside Bolivia. Nestor Alexander Flores, a law student from Beni, one of the Media Luna provinces, explained how support for the Morales administration is diminishing.
Now the majority in Beni is against the government. During the elections, there were MAS sympathizers. But now, on seeing the emergence of a socialist system and the application of Chavez and Cuban-style policies, the same people are realizing that a socialist system that failed in the world shouldn't be applied here.
On November 24th, the Constituent Assembly approved a general framework for the new constitution amidst violent clashes that left three people dead. Members of the Media Luna are refusing to recognize this new draft. They have threatened to declare de facto autonomy if by December 15th the government persists in its steadfast defense of the Constituent Assembly, which still must review the text article by article and vote on the revised document. Articles that do not receive two-thirds approval will be sent to voters for a final decision in a referendum next year. In a risky surprise move, President Evo Morales on Thursday called for a referendum to be held on his leadership as well as the mandate of the 9 governors to give the people a chance to say if they are for or against the process of change he claimed. 8 of the 9 governors have accepted his offer for a popular vote of confidence. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Juliet Beck and Aldo Oriana Lopez reporting from Bolivia.
Walmart workers in Mexico City are demanding more humane working conditions and the chance to form an independent union outside of the corrupt unions that dominate Mexico. Workers recently protested outside a store, calling for a change in the retail giant's policies and urging shoppers to boycott. The protest was organized by a growing underground network of employees calling themselves the Association of Walmart Workers. Walmart expressed surprise at the protest, emphasizing that it's the largest employer in Mexico and stating that they have no problems with their employees. But according to the workers, up to 60% of employees are part of the underground movement. FSRN correspondent Trevor Snapp reports from Mexico City.
Over the weekend, a group of labor activists in Mexico City spent Sunday afternoon in the parking lot of one of Walmart's first stores in Mexico. Protester Paula Houdina stood next to a gigantic blow-up yogurt container holding a handwritten sign.
They helped with the election fraud against Manuel López to get less taxes. They exploit the workers and affect the small businesses.
This protest was the first attempt at a demonstration organized entirely by Walmart employees. Juan López, a member of the Association of Walmart Workers who planned the protest, explains their decision to organize. His name has been changed to protect his identity.
When a worker asks for his rights as a worker, they fire him. For this reason, it's not possible to ask for change openly. So this is why our organization is anonymous and underground. As there is no real communication inside, we had to create this organization. We structured it like a network, a group for each business, and the lower cells don't know who is in the higher cells. We are asking for dignity, no more. We don't want privileges, just respect.
No deseamos privilegios, deseamos respeto a nuestra dignidad.
Almost all Walmart of Mexico employees are part of a union, but in effect the unions are no different than the company. Instead of fighting unions as it does in the U.S., Walmart pays the union its fees and in return receives its full cooperation. Last year, the Association of Walmart Workers wrote the company a series of letters detailing their demands for change. When they received no response, they went directly to the Secretary of Labor. The request for an interview was refused. Maria Pantoja is a Mexican City representative of Global Exchange, a San Francisco-based group helping local workers to organize.
It's very particular, this way of organizing, you know, within Walmart, because management, they know they are there. But it's like almost like a guerrilla war. You know, they know they're there, but they don't know who they are.
Walmart's Director of Communications, Antonio Ocaranza, says that the company has a mechanism to address the workers' concerns.
We have an open-door policy in Walmart. We have no idea of who these alleged workers are. We don't even know if they exist.
Ocaranza denies any unrest in the company, and neither he nor the workers know the full scale of the new organization's strength. Yet the workers are confident that our movement will grow because it allows the employees the chance to communicate about the most dehumanizing aspects of Walmart's work environment. Free Speech Radio News, Trevor Snapp, Mexico City.
You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. From KPFK in LA, I'm Aura Bogado.